Welcome to the Language Mastery Podcast. This is your host, John Fotheringham. In today's show, I chat with Ollie Richards, who blogs over at iwillteachyoualanguage.com, where he shares honest advice and practical tips for learning foreign languages. So you were, right now your mission is learning Cantonese.
That's, well, yeah.
Guitar, I mean, or one of. That's your plus one mission then, or?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to be honest with you, with the way that things have worked out, it's on the back burner big time. Because I'm trying to get an MA finished. I'm in the last stretches of the dissertation, so I'm basically just hitting that with every free minute that I've got. So for the last,
what's your degree in?
It's applied linguistics.
Oh, nice. Oh man, I'm jealous.
Well, I don't know. It's not that much.
I know it's grass is greener, but yeah, it's been on my radar for 12 years now, and I still get to. I've been accepted now, I think, four times to different programs, and just never had the money to do it. So.
Yeah, it's not cheap, but the thing is, it just opens up university teaching, and then you can, I mean, in Japan, for example, if you've got an MA, you could get into universities and you've got a really, really sweet deal.
Right.
Yeah, you get paid very well, long holidays, low teaching hours. It's certainly the only long term option, I think.
Yep. Yeah, I've run up against that wall many times. Like, well, yeah. I've got 10 years experience and TESOL and degree in linguistics, like, do you have an MA? No.
Yeah.
Walk out the door with my terrible. Tail through my legs.
And you get these guys who sort of just went into, did a master's straight after their undergrad degree because they couldn't think of anything else to do, and did it in, I don't know, sociology or whatever, and they can just walk into a university job anywhere they want,
right?
Just by virtue of the fact that they've got that MA. So, that's just the world of academia for you, I think.
Yep, there it goes.
So, in terms of Cantonese, I've been, I signed up to the add one thing, but it's been a I'm doing my sort of daily, my daily 30 minutes, but it's not a full on mission at the moment.
What can you tell us a bit more about what is that approach, or I've heard of it and I'm familiar with it, but maybe for the listener's sake, what is a plus, what is a mission, what does it entail?
Okay, well, the plus one, as it was conceived by Brian, who put it together, his whole idea was that that we need support when we're learning a language, right? So by getting a group of people together and supporting each other mutually, that is a great way of giving people the support that they need and just bolstering people in the mission. So they would spend 30 days, they'd set their own goals. And, so you had some people joining who were already fairly proficient in the language and just wanted to up their level. And then there were some people who like me were complete beginners. And so everyone sets their goals for the 3 months. And then they use the community as a sort of support mechanism to keep them going.
There's the social accountability aspect of it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I kind of see it as kind of crowdsourcing motivation.
I love it.
Rather than just doing it on your own, you've got people there going through the same thing. Because, as we know, when language only takes time.
Yeah.
And you need...
No, Pimser told me it only takes 10 days. So, and marketers never lie, right? So.
Well, yeah, I'd double check on that if I were you.
It's funny, I posted one of their little animated videos, which it was a great video. I had some good stuff in it. But the title was, it was their title, is Learn a Language in 10 Days. And I added a question mark on the end of it. And it was funny to see people reply to it that they thought I was, endorsing you can learn a language in 10 days. And the whole point was to, make quite the opposite point. But.
Yes, no, I think I remember seeing that actually. And I guess the thing is that, for most people, the reality is that a language endeavor is going to be a matter of 2 years. to get to any kind of decent level. And if you're doing that on your own, it's a long, hard slog. And so I think, you know, anything that you can do to motivate yourself and to keep the motivation up is a massive benefit. And you know, there's nothing better than having a community of people around you who are doing the same thing. What's that saying, that, you know, you are the average of the five people you spend the most time with, right? So if those five people around you are all language learners, you know, inevitably you're going to do better. And so I think that's the approach that Brian's trying to get at with the Ad One, and it's fantastic.
It's also that, I think, competitive nature, that, you know, a little bit of friendly competition with friends. I think you always want to work a little harder just to, you know, make sure you spent, you know, 30 minutes more than Joe, or, you know, did that many more reps in Anki than Bill. That helps.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know.
For me, it does.
Yeah, I don't know how much that is the case for the individual people in there. I think for a lot of people, you know, what really makes the difference is actually doing the thing or not. You know, whether you do 15 minutes a day or 30 minutes a day, I mean, you know, in the long term, that's neither here nor there. But what really makes the difference is the point at which you say, okay, I can't be bothered with this anymore. I've had enough. I'm gonna stop. And that's the thing, is that point at which you're tempted to give up and throw in the towel. That seeing all the other people
throw the book at the cat, I think, as you said.
Right. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
You know, that's the point at which having those people around you can make the difference between quitting or not.
Which I think is a good intro to the difference between your Cantonese mission in the beginning and, I think, French you talked about. You know, the language basically taught itself to you because you were in France, you were surrounded by French, and you really had no choice. So what are some of the ways that you, you know, what made the difference then in Cantonese? What did you have to do differently to create that, you know?
Yeah, it's a great question, because for me, the Cantonese has been, it's caused me to completely look again at my whole approach to language learning, because my complete history up until Cantonese, and I think for me, this is language 7 or 8 that I've tackled, and the thing is that with every language that I've tackled up to that point, I've either been living in the country where the language is spoken, or else had a bunch of people around me who speak that language, and for me, the motivation factor of having those people around me, being in that social situation, has really been all the drive that I've needed to make progress and to get it done over the long term. But in this situation with Cantonese, it's the first time that I've had to learn a language without being surrounded by the language every day, without having that community around me. So, you know, I went through quite a lot of ups and downs as I was trying to figure out what was going to work best for me. But I think, you know, ultimately, one of the things that I've realized is that you need to have a good relationship with time. You know, you can't make time your enemy, because it's going to come back stronger. And what I mean by that is, I think if you start to approach a language with goals that are too big, you know, saying I'm going to do 2 or 3 hours a day, or even an hour a day can be too much for some people. If you approach it that way, you're essentially setting yourself up for failure, because it's very difficult for most people to maintain a big commitment like that on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. And it certainly was for me. You know, I'm experienced with languages. I've done it before a number of times, and yet still for me, I find I'm not great with routine. I'm not great with doing the thing every day. And so I had to really adjust my expectations, and I had to boil it down to one thing, which is, right, what can I do every day which is going to make the difference and just keep me on track?
What were some of those things that were different?
Yeah, sure. Well, I, without having the people around me, I ended up basically focusing on input, mm-hmm. as a replacement for those people. So I'd be listening to podcasts. I'd be watching movies and dramas. I'd be using a couple of textbooks that I found, Complete Cantonese, which is a Teach Yourself series, and also I tried the FSI Cantonese course. So a variety of different sources. And you know, I get bored quite easily. I've got a fairly short attention span. And, you know, I'm not the kind of person that can sit and work my way through a book in its entirety. I get bored too easily. Mm-hmm. And so I need to have a variety of different things that I can sort of, you know, chop and change between depending on what mood I'm in and what I fancy doing. So one of the big things that I think come across is the idea that you have to have a big pool of resources that you can draw on for the time that you need them. Does that make sense? Are you
absolutely
following?
Yeah. And I was going to actually ask you later, but this would be a good segue to that. For Cantonese specifically or languages in general, what are a couple of your favorite pools of resources, either online or offline?
Yeah, well, Cantonese is as you hinted at, it's kind of a minority language.
Yeah.
And it's difficult to find.
It shouldn't be, but somehow it is. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just eclipsed by Mandarin in a big way. But you know, this has also presented a unique problem. I find, in a way, it's kind of a double whammy, because not only am I sort of doing this for the first time at distance, but I'm also kind of stuck for interesting resources. And so, you know, if I was studying a more common language, then I would probably use as my main resource is I'd go to Steve Kaufman's link site, and I would probably base my learning around that, because it's got all the essential ingredients of text and audio, the ability to extract vocabulary, a kind of built-in spaced repetition system, flashcards, mm-hmm. And a good pool of text available as well. So I think, you know, that for me really is one of the good resources out there. But for Cantonese, of course, Link doesn't support Cantonese. And a lot of the other series out there, resources out there, also don't support Cantonese. So recently I've done something really interesting, which is new for me. So before I was telling you about how I like to watch movies and dramas in Cantonese. And one of the things that I've done is I took one episode of my favorite Cantonese drama, which is called The Seventh Day. It's a classic cheesy love story. You should check it out sometime on the net. I took the drama and I hired a virtual assistant, a VA, to transcribe the whole thing for me in traditional Chinese characters, in the Yuping transliteration, and in English. And it's incredibly cheap to get this kind of thing done. It cost me, I think it was $20 US to get an entire 45-minute episode transcribed.
Wow.
And I asked them to put it into Microsoft Excel.
Oh, and just one column.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. One column for each part. And for the last few weeks, I've been basing all of my language learning on this. So I've been watching the drama, I've been following the script through, and I've been, you know, using that as the main source of input. And one of the great things about having it done in that way is that you can then export that Excel spreadsheet directly into your flashcard system. So I use an app called Flashcards Deluxe. And by just uploading it to Dropbox, I can then download that into separate sentences. Mm. And so wherever I am, I can just fire up the SRS app, and I can just basically test myself on all the language from the drama.
How does Flashcards Deluxe compare to Anki? I haven't used it.
Well, I mean, my main problem with Anki was always that I don't like being stuck in front of the computer when I'm doing flashcards. And when I looked at it a number of years ago, the trouble was that the iPhone app was something like $30.
It still is. I think it's $25.
Yeah,
I finally bit the bullet on it, but yeah. I read his, you know, his reasoning for that, that that then supports development for all the platforms, but that seems a little bit unfair.
Yeah, well, you know, absolutely, and you know, all credit to him. I mean, I know how popular Anki is, and yeah. and I think it's great. But the flashcards app is, I mean, it has a number of benefits. It's only $4 for a start, and it's an incredibly simple, powerful, fast system, and it's, you know, very clean interface, and it's very, very easy to input stuff. Nice. You can you've got text, you've got sound, you've got pictures, and you've got a lot of extra options, such as importing from an Excel spreadsheet, which in this case was what I did, and yeah, it's worked really, really well for me, because I like to do these things on the move rather than being stuck behind a desktop.
Right. Well, that's when you have usually those hidden moments, Barry Farber says, to actually review those things. So.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. So let's circle back to other resources then. So you mentioned, the seventh day, so dramas, getting those transcribed, which is, I think, brilliant. I think VA, you know, help is something that a lot of people just forget about. I mean, we've all heard of it now in terms of business use, but using it for our personal language learning endeavors, I think is brilliant. And I need to try more of that. I remember, I think Benny had mentioned that he has his VA do his Anki decks for him, you know, find the example sentences, import all the stuff. Cause that's definitely a huge time suck that I could definitely, used to get rid of.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, I mean, in fact, it's but the writing that Benny's done about how he uses his VAs, I mean, that has inspired me to kind of look into this and see, you know, kind of, I had it in the back of my mind for a while, and then you know, when I came to actually look for the resources I needed, that's when I thought, okay, well, hang on, how much would it actually cost to get this material that I want transcribed? And I just posted the job on Elance just out of curiosity, and I was just amazed at how much, you know, how affordable it can be to get this stuff done. And I absolutely agree. I think there's a lot of potential there, because, you know, if we look at what really makes the difference between people who are successful at language learning over the long term and not, I mean, for me, motivation is really the one thing that is going to call people out. You know, if that motivation isn't there, you know, you're finished. Yep. So I think the potential to get materials made for you that are based on your own interests is a hugely powerful thing. And whatever they are, whether it's you know, recipe books and cooking or drama or you know, judo books or whatever whatever you want. You know, if you can use these as
a Tim Ferriss reference.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking of. Yeah. I don't know if he knew about VAs at that point, but if he did, I'm sure maybe he would have gone down that route.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we can find ways of basing our learning around things that motivate us and around things that inspire us, I think, you know, that's a massive step forward.
Absolutely. What about, because I've talked about this a bit before, yeah, motivation, it's a precondition. If you don't have it, then it's a non-starter. But what about when motivation wanes? Because it inevitably does sometimes. What do you use to pick up the slack?
Well,
or how do you rebuild it? Or, you know,
yeah, you want, well, you know? I mean, I think to a certain extent it comes, you know, motivation is, it comes on different levels, doesn't it? But what's for sure is if you've got some basic routines in place, then I think that motivation is not such an issue, because if you've got, say, a 15-minute routine in the morning of listening to a podcast or doing flashcard decks for a while, you know, if you can just keep that going on a minimal level, then, you know, even if you're having a bad week or a bad month, this is something that you can use to just maintain that thing of doing it every day. Because, you know, it's the consistency that everyone needs. And what I've been doing is actually finding these routines that don't take much time, but that I can do every day, and just integrating it into my routine in a way that it becomes automatic. You know, just like making a breakfast smoothie or taking a shower or whatever it is. So I think that's the power of setting these routines and being clear about them, because you know everyone's got 15 minutes a day to base that on. So with that in place, I think that sets you up. But also, I think I come back to what I said earlier about the having a pool of different resources, because there was one point about 6 weeks or so ago when I was keeping up a fairly busy schedule of doing an hour a day. I'd have one focused hour a day on Cantonese, plus the podcasts in the car and the flashcard decks I do in a spare 5 minutes. And I burnt out one day. I didn't want to do it anymore. I had a lot on, and I just wasn't in the right frame of mind to be doing that intensive 1 hour a day of studying. And you know, I'm someone that doesn't want to spend time on stuff that I don't enjoy. And my whole history with language learning has been the only reason I do it is because I enjoy it. And as soon as I stop enjoying it, then I stop studying.
Right.
So what I did in that situation when I felt burnt out was I just fell back on movies and dramas. So rather than spending that 1 hour studying intensively, I would just fire up the TV and I'd watch an hour of dramas, or I'd go and watch an Andy Lau movie or whatever. And you know, even if you're feeling demotivated, you know, mm-hmm. you can always fit another movie in, can't you? So again, finding a wide enough pool of resources of things that interest you, so that, you know, for all, whether you're feeling good or bad or up or down, you've always got something there which you can fall back on and keep the language in your life in some kind of way.
That's a good point.
Mm. How about you? What have you done before?
I go similar. I mean, I have periods where I'm, you know, extra motivated, and I'll, you know, do much more focused, structured reviews of things. But then, yeah, you go through patches where you just don't feel like it. And, you know, admittedly, there are times when I fall off completely. But other times, just like you, I go back to anime. I go back to manga.
Right.
Things that are inherently fun that I would read or, you know, consume in English. I just try to find those things in Mandarin or Japanese or...
Okay, yeah, sure.
Yeah, whatever the language is I'm focusing on. No, I think that's a really good point.
And I think that what you mentioned about falling off the train, I mean, I think that is, for me personally anyway, I mean, I think that we really want to avoid that stage where we stop doing anything at all.
Yeah. It's so because hard to get back up.
Yeah, once you're down, getting up again is so much more of a struggle. So for me, I think, you know, avoiding that state of giving up completely is what we really want to aim for. You go down to 5 minutes a day, you know, that's still 5 minutes of input, and it still counts towards, you know, the overall time that you're spending with the language. And you know, once you go down to nothing, it's, you know, it can be tough to get back up, especially if you're like me and you kind of flick from one thing to the other a bit too much.
Yep. No, I think we're kindred spirits in that regard. Yeah. A trick I've done in the last couple months is I promised myself 1 minute, just 1 minute a day. That's it. I mean, I usually end up doing an hour, but it, that psychological trick of knowing I'm only committed to 1 minute means I'm going to do it.
Whereas
I think you mentioned earlier in the interview, don't start off too ambitious and say, I'm going to do 3 hours a day, because then you're setting yourself up for failure. Same idea. I just start with 1 minute. And usually it ends up being, 30 minutes, an hour, 2 hours, whatever ends up coming. But
yeah, absolutely. And in fact, it's interesting you mentioned that, because one of my most popular posts on my site was entitled, how to do 1 hour study in 5 minutes. And it's exactly what you said. It's the trick of telling yourself, right, I'm going to do 5 minutes of flashcards.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason I wrote the post was because I was on holiday in Indonesia, and I said to myself, my wife was a little bit unhappy because I was sort of writing blog posts and things like that, and so I said, right, I've got to spend some time with her. We've got to go and have dinner. But before we do that, I'm just going to do 5 minutes of flashcards. 45 minutes later, my head comes up and I realize, I've just been, that 5 minutes has turned into getting on for an hour. And what it is exactly what you said, John, it's just get started. Mm-hmm. Just do that 1 minute. I mean, for me, it was 5 minutes. For you, it's 1 minute. And I think that's probably even better. Just do 60 seconds. Because your brain will say, okay, no problem. But you will almost certainly do more than that.
I'm trying to, I just put it in one of my previous newsletters. I think I can't remember the name of it. It's a psychological effect that we don't like things unfinished. And so when you start something, you're more likely to finish it.
What is it called? Right.
It's some German psychologist's name.
I know what you mean. And that's exactly that. And so much of what we do comes down to these little psychological quirks. I really think that for a lot of people, certainly, I mean, people, I get questions quite a lot from readers asking some fairly, questions like, I just can't get started, or I just don't know which method is right, or right. It just seems like such a big task. These questions, which ultimately I think come down to a psychological barrier of some description, mm-hmm. whether it's just getting started or whether it's something else. I think that so much of the language learning game is about managing ourselves and understanding how we work. And I think that has to take, certainly for me, it's 95% of the game for me. Just figuring out what I like, what I do, what I like doing, what I'm not gonna do.
Right.
And only once I've figured that stuff out can I actually get down and make some progress.
Yeah, what are our failure points? What are our hot buttons? What are the things that I mean, that's something I've done this year, only took me 33 years of life to figure it out. But being truly honest with myself about, when and why do I fail? When do I fall off the wagon? Not only just on language, but on, I'm very interested in nutrition, but sometimes I'll be, continually eating things I know I shouldn't be. And there's a couple very, specific and consistent triggers I found that happen every time. And so if I know what those triggers are, then I can at least avoid them if possible, or when they do happen, be conscious of it enough not to let them, completely knock me off.
Yeah, I mean, what are those triggers for you, John, if it's not too personal?
Yeah, no. Well, they kind of are, but I think one definitely is exercise, training. So I do Wing Chun. I like to do Olympic weightlifting. So if I skip workouts, that's a huge trigger. I skip a workout, I'm going to skip studying the next day, inevitably. It's a psychological cascade of laziness and, lethargy that just kind of takes over everything. Drinking, I think, is a big one. Whether it's, biochemical or just, it loosens you up. But if I go beyond one or two glasses of wine, definitely, then it also leads to eating things I shouldn't. And then you also don't feel like working out. And then, again, the same chain of things. So, yeah. Those two things.
So what's interesting then is you talked about the physical side of it and the chemistry within our bodies. And it sounds like we're getting off track a little bit, but I don't think we are, because I think these things all form part of the equation when we're looking at something, when we're looking at a task as big as language learning. And, the kind of the dedication and the sticking power that it takes over a couple of years to really do that thing. Just like you said, if you have a few too many one weekend, for the next couple of days, you can wake up feeling a little bit dazed and, mm-hmm. Not quite so up for it. And that, you're crazy if you think that's not going to have an effect on the language learning that you've committed to doing that day.
But it's funny, most people don't want to talk about it, or they feel uncomfortable talking about it, or as you said, they think it's off the topic. And I've actually had some feedback in an earlier version of my Master Japanese Guide. I had a whole section on fitness and nutrition. I thought that's essential if you, for the same reasons we just talked about, if you don't have that nailed, you know, your language learning is going to suffer. But I had complaints that I bought a book about Japanese learning. Why are you talking about what I should eat?
Yeah, I can see how it's a hard sell, but
it is. But I took it out, but I ended up just putting it up as a blog post on my site instead.
That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah, but yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think for the same reason that a lot of people say, you know, I'm quite shy and I don't really want to do language exchanges on Skype, for example. Mm-hmm. You know, for me, one of the big constant in all my language learning has been language exchanges with people. That's what's really made the big difference for me at kind of crucial times of my learning. And I'd say for anyone that, you know, maybe not right at the beginning, but certainly sooner or later, you know, you have to start speaking to you know, to continue your motivation. Mm-hmm. And yet what the reason that people don't necessarily want to do that or feel that they can't do it is, I don't think it's a linguistic thing, really. I think it's a psychological thing, and it has to do with people's disposition to talking to strangers on the phone, and of course a little bit of maybe nervousness about their level of language. But again, I think it's an example of how you know, controlling yourself and controlling your mind is absolutely crucial to the task.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember the word. I think it was biopsychosocial.
Biopsychosocial. Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Hard to can't even get it out. Yeah. Biopsychosocial. Yeah, but something like language. It's a bio. Can I say it again? Biopsychosocial skill. It's not just your brain. It's not just your, you know, your ears and mouth. It's your whole body. It's your whole psychological package. And it's your social world that you're interacting in. And
yeah,
you're so right. And it's funny, if you don't get over that fear, I think, of communicating in the beginning, it's not going to get any less, you know, even if you get really good in a language on an input level, you're still going to be scared then 2, 3, 5 years later when you try to speak. So,
Well, exactly. And I still remember very vividly, and I still get it now, you know, in my languages, if I'm walking down the street and I overhear a Japanese person talking, you know, the only thing I want to do is go and practice my Japanese at that point.
Right.
But it's no easy thing just to walk up to someone and start talking to them. Yeah. You know? And that has nothing to do with the language. I'm confident enough in my Japanese to do that, but I've never been particularly confident walking up to people in the street and just starting talking to them. You know, it's not me. Right.
Well, and we've also been, you know, having lived in Japan, you've probably been on the receiving end of that too many times, perhaps. I think there are good and bad ways to do it. You know, there's the lecherous, you know, let me practice English with you for free versus, you know, let's actually have a conversation. And, you know, different ways to do it.
But, you know, then again, we all know that if someone sort of nice and comes up to you and smiles and strikes up a conversation, I mean, who doesn't like that? Everyone likes
especially
that.
Especially when it's a pretty girl, that helps.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. But that's not to say that it's easy to do. And, you know, if someone comes up to me and starts chatting to me, I love it. I love that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's still a difficult thing to do. And so just to kind of bring this back full circle, I think that, you know, when I'm thinking about, you know, so content for my site, for example, and what I really want to get across to people, I mean, okay, I have to write about language learning, about the languages themselves, because that's what people expect. But what I really think is going to make the, you know, the 80% of the difference to people is really what we said before, understanding how we work, understanding what we can and can't do, and really, you know, doing the difficult thing of looking inside and really thinking about what we're capable of and what we're not capable of, and then maybe challenging some of those things.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I think, are you familiar with or do you subscribe to the multiple intelligences concept?
Oh, absolutely. I'm not particularly well read on it, but I know it's a huge area and quite an influential area. So it's on my list of on my very long list of things to
right.
read up on.
Yeah, the never ending list. I mean, it's there's some parts of it that I, you know, they call it intelligences. I think maybe a better word is just interests. But regardless, I think as you said, you know, identifying what are those things that you're naturally inclined toward and better at, and then, you know, leveraging those things as much as possible, but then also addressing maybe the weaknesses. And you know, I've taken, you know, a bunch of those different surveys, and interestingly, my linguistic intelligence is actually pretty low. It's one of the lowest intelligences on my survey.
Okay.
And so when I hear people say, "Oh, you must be good at languages," it's, you know, as we've all heard, we know that's not what it really is. It's I'm interested in languages. But then I use my other intelligences, like, you know, musical intelligence. And like, if I hear something, I can usually parrot it pretty well. You know, I'm good at impersonations, so, you know, I've always been good with accents. But my memory is complete rubbish. I mean, I have a terrible time remembering things. So, you know, having to learn new things, I've been forced to develop, you know, mnemonics and very, you know, vivid stories and ways to make stuff stick. So
yeah, sure. And again, you know, what does it mean to? I don't want to get too philosophical on this point, but I think it's really relevant. You know, what does it mean to learn a language? And you know, people have too often have this view of language as an academic pursuit. Mm-hmm. You know, something that is to be learned, just like maths or science or chemistry. But what does it mean for us? I mean, you know, I'm quite happy to admit that I haven't got to as high a level in any of my languages that I think I could or that I would like to. But what these languages mean for me personally is the ability to communicate with people, to go to places and to talk to people in their language. That's what it means to me. And if I were to just spend my life reading books and not have the opportunity to speak to people, that would become, you know, entirely meaningless for me. In the same way that, you know, when Benny talked about learning his languages, you know, by his own admission, you know, he's not a language learner. He sees himself as a traveler,
right?
Because for him, you know, this crazy idea of learning a language in 3 months is not just something that he dreamt up for the sake of it. It's because he's going to the country and he wants to be able to use the language for traveling. So, you know, I think we've all got these instrumental aims in what we're doing, and I think it's dangerous to ignore what they are and to try and be someone else, because ultimately I think it's going to work against you. And that's not to say that it's necessarily easy to know what it is that we want or what it is that we want we're actually aiming for, but if we can reach a stage where we've got some clarity over that, then we're much more likely to be successful.
Absolutely. What's your aim with Cantonese, or what was your aim when you began?
To a certain extent, Cantonese for me was a bit of a departure, because I'd been to Hong Kong a couple of times. I love the language. I love the people. I've got a number of friends in back in London from Hong Kong, and it was immediately obvious to me from the start that it's a very playful language and a very very rich language. I mean, just by listening to people talk, mm-hmm. you can kind of sense the depth of
awesome.
Of expression. Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing, and so. I just kind of, you know, when you have an attraction that just kind of creeps up on you, that's what happened to me with Cantonese, and I found myself more and more drawn towards it. And so looking for a project for the next language, that was the obvious choice for me. I did sort of dabble in Arabic for a while. I learned to read and write whilst I was here. In Qatar, but it just didn't grab me. It doesn't Arabic, for whatever reason, just doesn't have the appeal for me that other languages do. But Cantonese has, and so that's really what motivated me. Again, it's because I found myself liking it and attracted to it for whatever reason. It was really the only choice for me.
That's cool. Yeah, it's on my list. I do Wing Chun, as I mentioned, and my Seagong he's from Hong Kong, but he lived in the UK for about 12 years or so. So he has a wonderful mix between Cantonese and Cockney British. It's a really interesting blend. Yeah.
That sounds cool. And also for someone that speaks Mandarin, I think you have an easy.
Yeah. I was watching one of your, I think your 2 month video, and I was even picking up on, you know, some of the words are very similar and some of course are very different, but I think there's enough crossover to at least have some sticking points to attach stuff to. So.
Yeah. And of course you've got the writing basics there,
right,
as well.
You know, yeah. That's such a huge advantage. Cause I started with Japanese and then I went to Mandarin and, you know, in Taiwan. So it's traditional. And that was such a huge head start. Even though I was focused on speaking in the beginning, being able to find transcripts of stuff to then come back to and then review, that's such an advantage.
Yeah. And I think that, I mean, that on that particular point, that's what trips up a lot of people in Japan, is the fact that they don't, and I'm sure it happens in China as well, but I don't have direct experience of that. In Japan, you get people who really want to learn Japanese, but can't quite bring themselves to spend the time on the kanji and learning to read and write Chinese characters. And so they deprive themselves of all of that reading input. And, you know, without being able to read, I think you're really limiting yourself to where you can get, you know, and it comes back to this thing of having enough input from different places. And a massive part of that for me is reading and the ability to read. It's absolutely crucial, especially in a language like Japanese, because it is very easy.
There's so much, they have such a beautiful literary tradition that, you know, you can read, you know, Murakami in English, but you're not reading Murakami. You're reading a translator's interpretation of it.
And, yeah.
As good as they are, it's not him.
So. Sure, but I think even before you get to the stage of reading Murakami, I mean, you've got, if you don't learn the kanji, for example, you can't read things around you. You can't read the adverts.
Can't order sushi. In most sushi places you go to only have kanji, or you know, some of it's hiragana.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can always point.
But being able to.
I did that, to be honest, but
yeah.
you're depriving yourself of so much rich exposure, and you know, so I think it's such an important thing.
And it's in a lot of ways, I think Isaac said that in many ways kanji are actually the most rational part of Japanese. I mean, at least how they're written, the writing and the meaning is actually much more rational than the readings, the pronunciation. So, and I think if you go about it in a, you know, as I say, an adult friendly way, it's not, I refuse to use the word difficult. I'm not going to say it's easy either, but it's not difficult. It's time consuming. Yes. You know, and it's going to have to rely on all those, you know, the routines you talked about, the motivation, the psychology, but, really, I think it's been puffed up to be so much harder and more arduous than it really is. By the Japanese themselves, but, too, to be honest. I mean, they perpetuate that myth themselves, I think.
But yeah, but I think that that's possibly also perpetuated by the fact that they see foreigners coming to Japan and, you know, invariably not learning Japanese. And so that just leads to the assumption that, well, it can't be done.
Right.
Whereas I think, you know, again, it's a very kind of Western-centric, if that's a word.
Sure.
I'm used to saying Eurocentric. But that doesn't include America, obviously.
Yeah, it might be. Kind of I'd be slightly miffed at that. No,
yeah. So you know, we coming from English as a native language, you know, we're very spoiled by the fact that French and Spanish and German, Italian, Portuguese are very accessible for us, mm-hmm. So you know, to a certain extent, we are kind of used, and those are the languages we study at school, right? So we are kind of used to languages with the same alphabet, with words and vocabulary that are derived from the same origins, And I think we're spoiled by that. So when we go to study, for example, Japanese and Chinese, you're right. It's not that they are any lexically poorer than French or Spanish, but it's just a different thing, and it requires requires time to acclimatize to that language and to get familiar with the different components of it. I mean, you're right. It's not easy. I think it probably is slightly difficult, just from the sense in the sense that you that to learn Chinese characters, you've got a large body of things to learn there. But it's a challenge, but it's certainly not insurmountable. And yeah. And you know, if I were to start all over again, I would definitely go back and focus on kanji, just for the long game, you know.
I wasted, I think, probably a year, 2 years, maybe, doing it a very stupid way. And then, luckily, at university, they had a course where we used remembering the kanji. That was actually the assigned text. We had a very forward-looking professor. He was actually a Italian professor who also was fluent in Japanese. So, he ended up actually being one of the best teachers of all. And I found that to be the case. Again and again, that non-native speakers end up being much better teachers in the long run for other non-native speakers.
Yeah, well, it's interesting you say that because I've heard you be not quite so classroom friendly in the past.
I'm not. Yeah, well, it's funny because I think I probably need to, you know, preface that better because I think I love teachers. I've been one many years. I think they have a phenomenal role to play, and I'm you know. Probably in my core, I am an academic. I like academia, but I think I've just seen it abused and misused so much in language learning that I've spent a lot of my breath, I think, trying to point out the flaws in how language is usually taught. As you said, you know, people make the mistake of thinking of language as an academic subject, which it, you know, maybe vocabulary is, etymology is, but beyond that, it's much more a physical, biopsychosocial skill. I got it out this time. But no, I'm not anti-classroom. I'm pro-learner. I'll put it that way. I think, just as you do, I mean, I think our role here is empowering independent learners with the tools and the strategies they need to learn no matter where they live. I mean, learning Cantonese in Qatar or learning Japanese in Kansas, you know, it's possible if you go about it right.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, we're kind of maybe opening Pandora's box slightly by going down this road, but I think that one of the issues with classrooms is that modern teaching methodology, I think, has been designed to do as good a job as possible with, say, 20 students in the room. Mm-hmm. And I think to that extent, it can be as efficient as it's possible for it to be,
right.
But that unfortunately just can't compare to one motivated individual. Absolutely. Working on their own and going after it because they want it really badly.
Right.
And so I think classrooms are a necessary evil.
Mm-hmm.
Personally, I'd like to. Add a minimum qualification to language teachers, which is that they must speak at least one foreign language.
Yes.
Themselves. Applause. Fluently.
Yes.
So that they've had some kind of experience of going through the process themselves. I that would be a huge improvement, I think.
But yes, I think you're quite right that it's a, well, maybe not even necessarily evil, just it's a societal necessity, and it has its advantages, I think, especially if you just move to a country and you're looking to make new friends, for example, you know, that's a great pool. As long as you don't, you know, fall into a little gaijin bubble, as many do.
Sure. But again, this doesn't come all the way back to what we were talking about earlier about it's the non-linguistic elements which really make the difference between success and not in so many cases. You know, it's not that what you're, you know, let's say you move to Japan and you study in a language school. It's not the fact that the teaching of the Japanese is necessarily bad, but is a number of knock-on effects. You know, you might end up falling in with a foreign crowd and not using Japanese. The fact that you go and pay for a language lesson means that you kind of, in a way, you're putting the responsibility on someone else, and so instead you don't spend the time studying at home instead. There's all these kind of peripheral issues which can get in the way of the real business of learning. So, yeah, there you go. Keeps cropping up.
No, I think actually that would be a good post. The non-linguistic
elements. Yeah.
I think I've circled around it. I don't think I've come at that head on yet enough.
Yeah, I think it could even be a book.
Yeah, there you go. Think of a quirky name, though. Yeah, so true. Yeah, and I just again circling back to the classroom, the other part which I think I've mentioned a few times is that I've had excellent teachers and I've had horrible teachers, and that's another reason why I think I'm very critical of classrooms, especially for beginners. Is I think more often than not they kill motivation, especially in Japanese. I found a lot of especially traditional Japanese teachers can be. Just because of the way languages are taught there, I think they can be very demotivating. Is that a word? Unmotivating?
Yeah. But it all comes back to what motivates you, doesn't it? Like I said, for me, you know, what motivates me is actually speaking with people, you know, on the ground. What motivates Benny is traveling to the country. If you're stuck in a classroom with having grammar lectures delivered at you day after day, you know, what is it that motivates you? Because I doubt it's the grammar that's motivating you to study. So
doing well on tests.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's the academic imposition, isn't it, on the class, on the whole subject that makes it problematic. And I think the best that any classroom can hope for is to find what individuals are motivated by and then help them to pursue that route. I think that's really the best that you can hope for. Absolutely. In many ways.
And when I was in Taiwan teaching, that was one of the most effective things I figured out after lots of trial and error, was the best thing I could do as a teacher was find materials and methods that each student loved. Because, it takes me 2 minutes to go on Google and search for something, whereas them, they would search for hours and not find anything. And so for me to use my advantage as a native speaker to go find resources for them, bring them back, and then go through them together, they got so much more out of it. They were so much more motivated, and it was a win-win. So.
Yeah, and you don't even have to mention the word grammar.
Exactly. They didn't know. Yeah, it was stealth grammar, they called it.
Stealth. Yeah, I love it. Yeah.
They did. Stealth grammar, stealth vocab, all those things. Stealth pronunciation. We would listen to something and then we would, I'd pronounce it for them slowly. They'd pronounce it, then I'd have them use the words on their own. And then, they were just having fun talking about BMWs or, whatever they were into, not realizing that they were getting much, much better than they had sitting in a, traditional class. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, what you've just said, I mean, that actually, there's a kind of a long tradition of doing this, stretching back to the 80s, among the kind of more enlightened language learning crowd. And it's called a negotiated syllabus. Mm-hmm. And it's commonly thought of as one of the most powerful mechanisms there is. The difficulty is when that starts to meet reality and the school wants to sell course books. And then students buy the course book, and because they've bought the course book, they want to use it. And then so you start to get, as with so many of these things, when you meet reality,
yep,
it's just not quite so simple anymore.
Well, there's the course, there's the sales side, but there's also the, the measurement. They want to know what structures and what words have they learned or will they learn in this particular level, by X number of hours. And in a more organic student-driven syllabus, that's hard, if not impossible, to do, which, begs the point of what's the point of those measurements in the first place if they don't really lead to any results. But that's an entirely different discussion, isn't it?
It is. We're opening Pandora's box here.
Yeah. Well, that'll be the part two next time. We'll talk about the educational side more. Because it sounds like I did TESOL, and I'd done a lot of language teaching related stuff in my linguistics degree. But sounds like you've got a very broad experience in that world. So I'd love to talk about that more.
Yeah, well, we can make it into a 5-part series or something.
There you go. Sounds like a plan. Well, it's late at night for you. I'm just getting started, so I better let you get some sleep.
Yeah, no, I could go on for hours. You're gonna have to cut me off, otherwise your listeners are gonna hate me.
Well, I doubt that, but for the sake of your brain and language learning bandwidth tomorrow, I better let you call it a night.
All right, John. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Pleasure's mine. All right, man. Rest well.
Take care, John.
All right. Talk to you soon.
God bless. See you, man. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Language Mastery Podcast. For more tips, tools, and tech, go to languagemastery.com. And if you've enjoyed the show, please consider rating us in iTunes.